Good morning. Welcome to Beijing Diary. The events of October 7th have started another war in the Middle East and created enormous unrest and conflict and debate around the world. But so much of the debate is engaged in by people who have almost zero knowledge of the history, what has transpired, and what has led up to what's taking place now. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit. First of all, we've been here before. We went through this in the history of, you know, the conflict between the Palestinians and the Jews, or we used to call the Arab-Israeli conflict. Obviously, I don't want to go into the whole history of the conflict, but basically, we all kind of have an idea there that the Zionist movement motivated many Jews, and also the Holocaust. The Holocaust gave great emphasis, or great impetus. The Zionist movement started a long time before World War II. But the Holocaust had the effect of bringing people in on the side of the Zionist movement. At any rate, in 1948, the Jews had their own country, and there has been conflict ever since. So it's just tough to try to understand this, because so much of the conflict, especially in the West, is engaged in by people who have little or no knowledge of what's going on. And I read an interesting article by a guy who just went around asking different protesters. You know, they were saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. And he said, can you name the river? Can you name the... And they couldn't, not Euphrates, whatever. You know, they didn't know what they were saying. I saw one guy interviewed who was talking about how Jews are killing babies. And the interviewer, the reporter said, Jews are killing babies? What about Hamas killing babies? He said, Hamas killing babies? I haven't heard anything about that. So the level of ignorance is quite profound. But there is a long-standing animosity toward Israel and their presence in Palestine, and also the way they treat the Palestinians. So I was talking with a young Israeli. They come to China. Very often they come to China. They like to travel in the western mountains of China. So I've seen them many times in the summertime. And they in Israel, all the young people have to serve in the military. I think it's 2 years. And so when they finish their military duty, they travel for a while and then get back and get to work with their studies. You know, they go to university after their military service. So very often these young people come to China, and I meet them in the western mountains of China. Now, for years I'd go up to the Tibetan Plateau. Spent four summers up in the north side, along with the border of Sichuan and Gansu province, 3,300 meters, a beautiful little village. And 2014, I went up to the other side, Daocheng. Anyway, it's very, very common to meet young Israelis traveling around the western mountains of China. And so, in recent years, you know, after all these, Beijing has really, really hot summers. I lived in Beijing for 16 years. I was teaching there. Really, really hot, miserable summers. And so summertime came. I'd generally grab my modem and head for the Tibetan Plateau. But in 2015, I just decided, you know, I'm going to take it easy a little bit. And I came down here to Kunming, which is a little bit more established. And you know, I just got tired of getting a loose stomach every summer, you know. So I don't see them as much here, but I did. Just a few months ago, I was talking to a young Israeli. One of my friends introduced me to him. Really nice guy. Really nice guy. So in discussing the larger context, it's a little difficult because the Israelis that I meet in China, both in the Western Mountains and in Beijing, will typically say something like, we're not religious, we're not religious, we're not religious. One time I was talking to someone at the coffee bar in Beijing. I said, you wouldn't mind being in Uganda? Because he told me, we don't care about the land. We're not religious. don't care about the land. I said, you wouldn't mind being in Uganda? He said, oh, no, we just want to be left alone. But I was talking to this young Israeli a few months ago, just a few months before the October 7th massacre. And so he said something. He seemed to want to emphasize that he was not opposed to to Arabs. You know, he wasn't just only in favor of Jews. He said, I love my country. I love all my country. And I love Arab Israelis, Jewish Israelis. I love all of them. And so I said, well, what about the Palestinians? And I think I mentioned Gaza. And he said, I don't want them in my country. So, you know, the feeling between when you come from the background of supporting Israel, everybody's talking about how anti-Semitism, everybody hates Israel. But, you know, there isn't a fancy name for anti-Palestinianism, but it's there. So we need to try to look at both sides of this. Yes, there is a despicable anti-Semitism in many parts of the world, and it has really raised its ugly head through the protests that have taken place since October 7th. But there's also among some Israelis, I'll say some because I'm not going to make a universal statement, but there is also an anti-Palestinianism that puts the Palestinians in a really, really difficult position. Now, I was watching just the 700 Club. They have I typically go to YouTube and look at 700 Club and look over their full episodes and then watch the first few minutes, because that's when they do the news. And then, you know, sometimes there'll be an interview or something later on, but mainly I watch the news item. And Gordon Robertson's on there saying, we need to be putting pressure on Hamas, not on Israel. No, we need to put pressure on both. Of course we don't want anti-Semitism, but we also need to take a look at how the Palestinians have been treated and where this resentment comes from. Now, we have to be very quick to state that no resentment justifies what Hamas did on October 7th. And this is my main problem with people who criticize Israel and who keep calling for ceasefire. They can't seem to bring themselves to condemn what Hamas did. So nothing, no context, no history justifies what happened on October 7th. We have to be very clear about that. It was despicable. It was horrifying. It was evil. And the monsters who did it were evil. And Hamas needs to be taken out. They need to be, you know, eliminated. I don't mean executing everybody. I mean completely removing Hamas from power. But mind you, the opponents of Israel have the same feeling about Israel. From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. That's about removing Israel from power. Sorry, it's not going to happen. Hamas does need to be removed from power. But we also need to take a look at the way Palestinians have been treated and how this has generated the resentment that leads to this kind of violence. So, first of all, the people. Are they really Jews? This is a big argument. Generally speaking, when we talk about the Jews, we use the, we talk about the Ashkenazim, if you want to use the Hebrew plural, the Ashkenazi Jews, the Ashkenazis, and the Sephardim. So if you, Sephardim, you think Spain, or the Iberian Peninsula, actually. That's Sephardic Judaism. Now, in my book review of The Concise History of the Middle East, which I'll put a link to, and you might be well to go back and read that review, there I have a link to an article that has four categories. But generally speaking, I speak in terms of the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazi Jews are the most significant in the present crisis because for two reasons. Number one, they are the power base in Israel. People in power are Ashkenazis, almost exclusively, I think. but also because it is widely believed by many people that the Ashkenazim are not really Jews. They are European converts to Judaism who, you know, kind of horned in on, you know, what was going on to get land in Israel or whatever. And this is something that many Americans don't realize. It is very widely believed that the Ashkenazi Jews are not really Jews. I personally do not believe that. But you can't understand this issue without understanding that problem. And I'll give you a link to a Palestinian pastor. He's an interesting guy because he's an American evangelical Christian, but he is a Palestinian. He does not believe that the Ashkenazim are Jews, real Jews, you know, that, which is to say that they're not really descended from Abraham. But at least he makes a distinction between the Ashkenazis and the Sephardim. Some people just say everybody in Israel, none of them are Jews, and of course that's ridiculous. But let me read the article from, let me read the statement from Wikipedia. I think this might be helpful. A couple of statements. This is, let me give you the name of this article so you can read it if you want to. It's just called Ashkenazi Jews. And I just want to read a couple of paragraphs. Genetic studies indicate that Ashkenazim have both Levantine and European, mainly Southern European ancestry. These studies draw diverging conclusions about the degree and sources of European admixture, with some focusing on the European genetic origin Ashkenazi maternal lineages, contrasting with the predominantly Middle Eastern genetic origin of the paternal lineages. Well, the admixture, European admixture, clearly there's been a European admixture among the Ashkenazis. They are the European Jewry. The Sephardim are the Iberian Peninsula, as I said. So, let me read the next paragraph. History. Like other Jewish ethnic groups, the Ashkenazi originate from the Israelites and Hebrews of historical Israel and Judah. Ashkenazi Jews share a significant amount of ancestry with other Jewish populations and derive their ancestry mostly from populations in the Middle East and Southern Europe. Other than their origins in ancient Israel, the question of how Ashkenazi Jews came to exist as a distinct community is unknown and has given rise to several theories. Well, that's an understatement. But I was at a coffee bar in Beijing one time, talking with one of my Muslim friends, Middle Eastern Muslim, and he was giving me this idea, you know, about sharing this idea about how the Ashkenazim are not really Jews. They're Europeans. They converted to Judaism and, you know, they don't belong in Palestine. Well, you know, if I really believed that the Ashkenazim were not Jews and they didn't belong there, they were interlopers, I mean, I might be inclined myself to say, go back to Germany and Poland, you know. But I don't believe that, but I do believe that they are Jews, but I'm fascinated by this discussion, because what you believe about things has a huge influence on how you approach it, right? And a lot of people aren't aware of this. Very widely believe that the Ashkenazim are not really Jews. So after we talked a little bit, we walked out into another part of the coffee bar, and he introduced me to his Israeli friend. So I turned to the Israeli and I said, what percentage of the Jews now living in Palestine are biological descendants of Abraham? And he said, 100%! 100%, you know, he was quite adamant. So this is quite a controversy, right? That belief underlies a lot of resentment toward Israel. Just be aware of that. Are the Ashkenazim. So the Ashkenazis, reason they're, as I said, they're so important is because they are the power base in Israel. You know, they're the power base in Israel. The people in power in Israel are people who many believe are not really Jews. That dynamic has got to be understood or you'll never get a grasp of this. Now, of course, there's another argument, and that is people who, you know, don't question that they're Jews, but say, homeland, that was 2,000 years ago. So just picture, you know, if you go into, who handles the property in America? Is it a state office or a county? Anyway, let's say you go into a county record office and you say that my neighbor stole my land. He So they ask you where the land is and look it up. And he said, well, it says here, he's got his title. Yes, he has a title to it, but that title was given to him by his parents, and it was stolen. He didn't steal it, but it was stolen. And so at some point they're going to say, well, when did this take place? Well, about 2,000 years ago. They're going to kick you out of there. So those are the two arguments. One is it whether they're Jews or not. You know, they don't get to come back after they've been gone for 2,000 years. But the other is that they're not really Jews. The Ashkenazim, not really Jews. So they are the pivot point of this whole issue. The Ashkenazi, the European Jewry, who migrated, the Zionists, you know, migrated to Israel and formed their state in 1948. So, a lot of times Americans will look at Israel and say, you know, if Israel would just behave themselves, they'd get along with their neighbors. No. No. Israel's greatest offense is existing. I mean, to the Palestinians and others who oppose them. Several years ago, I was talking with a PhD candidate from Tsinghua University in Beijing. Very bright young man. Very conversational, very interesting. And so I said to him, if I went to the West Bank today and asked 10 people, can you accept the existence of Israel as a country? And when I say that, I'm always careful not to say Jewish state, because I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to get into that issue. Just, can you accept the existence of Israel as a country? And I'll come back to that Jewish state issue. But that's the way I phrase it. Can you accept the existence of Israel as a country? I said, if I went to the West Bank and asked 10 people, can you accept the existence of Israel as a country? How many would say yes? And he said, maybe one. And then we talked a little further, and finally he blurted out, he said, in Jordan it would be zero. The land cannot be shared. The land cannot be shared. That's what he said. The land cannot be shared. So, there has been a resistance on the part of the Arab population to sharing the land with Israel. Sometimes people portray Israel as not wanting to share the land, but it's really the other way around. Now, in fairness, you could say, well, it's easy for Israel to say they will accept the 1947, or whatever year it was, partition, because they feel like if they accept a little bit now, they'll get more, they'll eventually get more. And they have been taking more. Well, be that as it may, there's strong resistance, and always has been, to sharing the land. A little while later, I was talking with some Egyptians, some of my students in Beijing. Said, Eric, we met some guys from Egypt. So we had dinner. We went down to Caesarea, and I can't remember the place now where it was. Anyway, so these guys, two guys from Egypt, they're very outgoing and very loud and boisterous, you know. I mean, just very active, energetic people. And I asked one of them, I said, if I went to Cairo today and asked 10 people, can you accept the existence of Israel as a country? How many would say yes? And he said, maybe 0.5. And we talked a little while, and then he said, I want you to know I'm part of the 9.5, not the 0.5. He wanted me to know he's from the 9.5. Well, I figured that out before he told me. So, you see, in this whole issue, it's somewhat disingenuous for people to complain about Israel behaves and not admit that, in fact, they wouldn't get along with Israel no matter how they behaved. They don't want them to exist. So just keep that in mind. Israel's number one crime, from the Arab perspective, is their existence. Now, that's changing, and the Trump administration, particularly Jared Kushner, did a lot to bring about an acceptance of Israel as a country. And the UAE has been most notable example of this. So they've pushed some change. Jared Kushner has been all his life intimately involved in the Israel situation. My tea is cold. That's one thing about tea. If it gets cold, you say, oh, it's iced tea. My tea is cold, or my iced tea is a little warm. anyway, when Jared Kushner was a little boy, his parents would come to him. Say, Jared, you have to sleep on the couch in the living room because Mr. Netanyahu is going to have your room tonight. So he grew up with the idea of, and the issues involving Israel. And he gets a lot of criticism, but I tell you what, I give him a lot of credit. I think what he accomplished with the help of Trump, who moved the embassy to Jerusalem, has increased Israel's posture and brought Arab nations who formerly would have been deeply hostile to their existence to start to accept their existence. Okay, but historically that's been a problem. It's not some specific thing Israel did wrong. It's their existence. Okay, so do they have a right to exist as a country? Do they have a right to exist as a country? One time I was talking to a kindergarten teacher in Beijing. She was Israeli. And I had my book on the Middle East. My book by Robert Fisk. She's a battlefield journalist. She was a journalist for The Independent, I guess it is. The book is called The Great War for Civilization. I've never actually gotten around to writing a review of this book. I should. But I actually haven't finished it. I started getting into the Algerian issue, and boy, I got so bloody I couldn't keep reading it. It's a massive book. But anyway, at the beginning of this book is a map. And so I opened up to the map, and I had her... I said to her, which countries do you have a problem going to? And she said, it's easier for me to show you the ones I can go to. And she pointed to Egypt and Turkey, I believe. Those two. Look at the whole area of the Middle East. Jews are not allowed. If you have an Israeli passport, you're not allowed to go to any of those. You'd probably be arrested. Well, you wouldn't, I don't know. They just wouldn't let you in the country, I guess. See, this is what Israel deals with. The right to exist as a country. Now, let me talk about the Jewish state thing. When I say Jewish state, I'm not talking about the Jewish religion, okay? I'm talking about the Jewish ethnicity. Now, the Christian scientists deny the Jewish ethnicity. And as I've just been talking about, others have a way of denying the ethnicity of the so-called Jews that are in Israel now. I say so-called because they're saying that they're called Jews, but they're not actually Jews. You see, so denial of their ethnicity, that's the denial of the nation. So that has something to do with a people's right. So when I talk to exist as a country, so when I say Jewish state, I'm not talking about the religion, I'm talking about Jewish ethnicity. Do the Jews have a right to have a state? I mean, do the Japanese have a right to have a Japanese state? Do the Norwegians have a right to have a Norwegian state? Do the French have a right to have a French state? Do the Arabs have a right to have an Arab state? They've got lots of them. So finally, then, do the Jews have a right to have a Jewish state? I mean, it's a simple question, right? But it's not a simple question because it gets mixed up with a religion. People say Judaism is just a religion. There is no ethnicity. That's nonsense. So, do they have a right to exist as a country? Now, that is, who's her name? Helen Douglas, I think. Anyway, I can't remember. She's a journalist and very older journalist in Washington, D.C. And she'd been, I think her name was Helen Douglas. I can't remember. I'll try to look it up. Too lazy right now. But I saw her interviewed one time. She was just on the lawn of the White House, started sounding off about Palestine. And you know, she had existed for all those years in Washington as a journalist, holding her tongue. And I think she comes from a Palestinian background. And somebody said to her, well, what do you expect the Israelis to do? What should they do? And she said, go back to Germany and Poland. Whoa. She was immediately fired. Immediately. But, you know, I talked to, you know, in China, when you meet foreigners in China, they tend to be sort of the left end of the spectrum. And they'll say to me, Americans, whatever, and also British too, we're not opposed to Jews. We don't hate Jews. We just don't believe in Israel. We're just opposed to Israel. In other words, they say they're not anti-Semitic, but they just don't believe that Israel should exist as a country. Do they have a right to exist as a country? No. My problem with Israel is not that they do not have a right to be there. I think they do have a right to be there. I'll talk about that in a minute. My concern is the way they treat Palestinians. So I am concerned about how they behave. Their existence, I believe they have a right to be there. And I think that's critical to how we deal with Israel. First acknowledge that they are there to stay, and then we deal with how they relate to Palestinians. If we're constantly saying that they don't really have a right to be there, you're fighting a losing battle. Now, I'm sure some would say that I have a bias because of my background as an evangelical Christian. And yes, I'll get into that. We're going to hear from Dr. Don Gray Barnhouse. But not entirely, because, for example, when I was living in Arizona, I went to a big mega church called Word of Grace, and that was when the Iraq situation, there were a lot of refugees coming. And so, I don't know, it's the Red Cross or who it is, they called the churches and asked them how many refugees they can take. And if I remember correctly, my church took about 100. So we had a refugee meeting. We had a meeting for dealing with the refugees, and you know, we volunteered to take a family and help them out. So I was assigned to a man and his wife, and they didn't have any kids yet. Hamid and Bushra, really, really nice people, and they were Iraqi Kurds from northern Iraq. And from that experience, I learned a lot about the Kurdish situation, which I'd been sort of aware of it, but became more aware of it. And so I just use that as an example, because the Kurds are a people without a country. Part of Kurdistan, you know, there's a place called Kurdistan. That's their country, but it has no legal borders. Part of it is in Iraq, part of it is in Syria, part of it is in Turkey. So I would like to see them have their own country. You know, this isn't just about religion. It's about allowing a people group to have their own country. I feel that way about them. I also feel that way about the Jews. So there is that element. But yes, of course, there is also the fact that the Bible clearly prophesies the future of Israel. So let's listen to Dr. Barnhouse, and then we can continue, pull this insight into it. Now, I should tell you that this Dr. Barnhouse operated in the mainly in the 40s and 50s. I think he died in 1960. So, you know, this is before the 1967 war, but after the 1948. And the radio program, he was pastor of the 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia for many years, and also had a radio program. And so these old tapes have been digitalized now, but they were good tapes, they're broadcast quality tapes. So the audio is quite good. You know, it's very old. The radio program that this comes from, this particular episode comes from, probably about the mid-50s, mid to late 50s. But the incident that he relates took place right after Israel became a nation, so that would be 1948. Okay, so I'll let you listen and we'll talk about it.
Do not think for one second that any righteousness or peace is going to come to this earth through the United Nations. Righteousness and peace will come to this earth only through a redeemed and restored Israel. Not from that pile of stone at the east end of 43rd Street in New York shall peace come to this earth, but from Jerusalem, fully possessed by Israel in the land. I recall an interesting incident which took place a day or two after the United Nations created the new nation of Israel. One of the large radio companies telephoned me to ask if I would appear on a forum program with a representative of the Arab people and a representative of the Zionist movement. The master of ceremonies sat with us a short while before we went on the air and announced the order of procedure. The Arab was to have 60 seconds to outline his case. The Jew was to have 60 seconds to announce the case of Israel. Then I was to speak for 60 seconds, after which there was to be general discussion. The Arab was in a white heat of terrible anger. The decision of the United Nations had been one of the great catastrophes of history. Blood would flow until the terrible wrong was righted. This had been a great step away from peace. And then the Zionist spoke. He was quiet and confident, and set forth the idea that now there would be peace in the Middle East, because since Israel had her little corner, she could now draw her children to her, and there would be no more pressure on the other countries, and peace would be the inevitable consequence from the Near East and throughout the Middle East. I began by saying that both were wrong in the light of the Bible. This was not a day of wrath, but the beginning of righteousness, or a type of it, because God had given the land to Israel in its ancient times, and she was going to possess it all. They would come into the full control of Jerusalem, and they would possess what is now Jordan, since that was the land of Ephraim and Manasseh. They would possess, but by this time, though I had spoken but 20 seconds of my minute, both sides attempted to interrupt me, the Arab frothing, the Jew telling me that they didn't want any more than that they then possessed. When the master of ceremonies reestablished quiet, and it was agreed that I might speak out my full minute, I told them that it was not a question of what they wanted or didn't want. God had sworn by himself that he would give the land to Abraham and to his seed forever. The names of Israel's children might be Jezreel, Lo-Ruhamah, and Lo-Ami today, but God is going to change them to planted, pitied, my people. The love and zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this.
So that's Donald Gray Barnhouse, evangelical leader in the first half of the last century, founder of Eternity Magazine. And that gives you kind of the perspective that has prevailed since the founding of the State of Israel among evangelicals, that this is a fulfillment of prophecy. Now, I didn't play the whole thing, you know, it's about a half-hour lecture. I recommend that you subscribe to the podcast. It's called Dr. Barnhouse in the Bible. It's a very old program, you know. They're all reel-to-reel tapes, broadcast tapes that have been digitalized. Because, as I said, I believe he died in 1960. So there is that perspective, you know. The idea of, and I'm not trying to make an argument now. The task of a teacher is primarily to inform, not to persuade, although there's a lot of crossover, because when there's misinformation, you have to persuade people that what you're saying is right and they're wrong. So rhetoric is involved with it. But there is that perspective, you see, that this is destined to come about. But what I really want to talk about is the way Palestinians have been treated. And they have been subjected to injustice. They have been victims of injustice. Now, I don't want to go into a lot of details because I just finished talking about this in my book review on the Concise History of the Middle East. So I will provide a link to that. Go back and read that. And there's still one video there of a young Palestinian boy. Their home had been taken over by Israelis. And now, to be fair, in the video they show them actually coming in, and I'm not sure if that's an actual footage or if that was staged. But the event did happen, nonetheless. And this young Palestinian boy, really nice, nice guy, and he says, I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. This is my house. They took my house. I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. Where does this resentment come from? And so that's why when I see, you know, evangelicals like Gordon Robertson saying, we need to put pressure on Hamas, not on Israel. No, you need to put pressure on anyone who is a perpetrator of injustice. And Israel has been a perpetrator of injustice. The strongest indication of this is that in every one of these conflicts, they have left Hamas in power. That their treatment, their handling of the situation has been way below standard. Now, somebody's going to ask me, Eric, what do you consider standard? So I'm going to give you the standard. I'm going to give you my standard, okay? Just so you know where I'm coming from. My standard is the occupation of Japan after World War II by Douglas MacArthur. The Americans, but Douglas MacArthur ruled Japan as a dictator for 5 years. Wrote the Japanese Constitution, which they are still using today. I mean, he himself didn't sit down and write it, but his team, he directed it. And he's largely responsible for what's in it. That's my standard, okay? And measured by that standard, I believe that Israel falls short. But also, I believe that people who accuse Israel are wrong when they talk about them being occupiers, at least with respect to Gaza. That brings another issue, though, because many of the people who talk about Israel as occupiers, they're not really talking about them just occupying Gaza, they're talking about them occupying Israel. So, it goes back to the right, whether or not they have a right to exist. You see, if you can't even acknowledge whether a country has a right to exist, how can you talk about the way that country behaves as a country? But I am talking about it, because I do support their right to exist. But their treatment of Gaza, my criticism there is not to call them occupiers. My main criticism there is that they're not occupying. They left it, and I'll never forget when it happened. Ariel Sharon was the leader. I was listening to Carolyn Click the other day. She said that he was in some legal trouble and he was trying to distract attention. I don't know. But it was a terrible, terrible disaster. And I'll never forget when that happened. I was listening to BBC or something, and a young member of the IDF was talking about his experience. He had to go in there and move the people out. He went into a synagogue, and his rabbis are clutching the Torah, you know, lying on the floor and screaming. I mean, he was just overwhelmed by it, you know, but he was torn because he was a Jew, but also a loyal member of the military, and, you know, he talked about that. He was a member of the IDF. We had a job to do, but it was a terrible, terrible mistake. Terrible mistake. Gaza City used to have a Jewish quarter, and it's a Gush Katif, you know, with a largely Jewish Israeli community. If those places had been in place, if Sharon had not taken that action, this whole disaster would not have happened. So, my main criticism of Israel is not that they're occupying, it's that they're refusing to occupy. And so, before 2006, I can remember the 67 war. Yay, Israel, you know, they won six days. And Yom Kippur, now, Six-Day War seems like a great victory, but you have to average it out between the Six-Day War and the 1973, the Yom Kippur. Because there, Israel did suffer some pretty severe casualty. You put the two together, it doesn't look quite so out of balance. But 1967, you know, yay Israel, I was cheering them on. 1973, they're attacked. And Richard Nixon in his memoirs talks about how his aides came to him and said, well, we're going to send three planes to Israel. And Nixon said, three planes? Why? And they said, well, that's what we feel we can handle politically. And he said, give Golda Meir whatever she wants, and let me worry about the politics. So, strong support of Israel. And they did come out ahead, eventually. Cheering them on, you know. That's 1973. 1956, I was only 2 years old. So, 67 was the first one that I was really tuned to. It wasn't too much following what happened in 78. I think it was a little shorter, but 1982, definitely, that's when Israel moved into Lebanon. Again, you know, supporting Israel and in the raid in Entebbe, when they went to Uganda and recovered their hostages. And when they, I think it was 1981, when they flew to Iraq and blew up that reactor. But 2006, I was in the mountains during the summer. In the summertime, I go to the Western Mountains. I'm sitting up there on the Tibetan Plateau, and it's a beautiful country, you know. But, you know, watching the news and seeing what was happening, and they ended up with a stalemate, you know. And I'm like, you guys, what in the world are you doing? You got to take his ball out. And ever since that, I've been really disillusioned with Israel's approach. They fought rocket fire from Gaza. That was 2000. I'm looking at this chart that I have put on my blog. If you go to the blog post for this episode, you'll see it. 2008 and 2009. 2006 was Hezbollah. That was northern Israel. Border of Israel, Lebanon. 2008 and 2009, Operation Cast Lead. That was rocket fire. Rocket fire from Gaza reduced, and that's called a victory, I guess. But Operation Pillar Defense 2012, Hamas. You know, Operation Protective Edge 2014, Hamas. Israeli-Palestine Crisis 2021, Hamas. And, of course, the one now is 2023, that's ongoing, but Hamas. So from 1, 2, 3, 4 different times with Hamas before the current one. And every time they left Hamas in power. What does that tell you? Clearly, they don't really care about the Palestinians. I was talking to a Western journalist in Beijing one time. I was at a lecture, and she described Gaza as a rabbit cage. I think it's a good description. But you see, when over and over and over again, you look at that chart yourself on my blog, you see the fighting with Hamas, and Hamas stays in power. It's not a victory until the enemy is defeated, you guys. Sorry. And so leaving Hamas in power, deliberately leaving Hamas in power, two problems. It shows they don't really care about the Palestinians. You know, they can be under those cruel terrorists. We don't care about that as long as they stay in their rabbit cage. But it also gives fuel to the accusations of terrorism. What is terrorism? It's tormenting the people in order to manipulate, you know, to create pressure on the population in order to influence the government to act. So, not attacking the military, but attacking the people. You're attacking the military, and then innocent people die. We call that collateral damage. There's a certain tolerance for that. But when you're attacking the people and terrorizing the people to manipulate action, that's terrorism. So, what is the standard? I said my standard is the occupation of Japan after World War II. But before the occupation, in the dropping of the bomb, there's a serious issue there. And I'll never forget, I think it was the first time it was when I was in college, and a professor played it or something, this tape of Truman saying, we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, a military base. A military base? It's a city with women and children. Now, believe it or not, I didn't realize this, but they made a decision to move the target. There was a military installation that they had targeted with that nuclear warhead for the first, you know, bomb, the first nuclear bomb. And somehow somebody said, you know, let's move that target over so we get the civilian population, because that will make more people more aware of it. Now, I'm not sure if Truman was aware of that decision. If he wasn't, it's pretty serious. But you guys, believe it or not, I did not know this. I knew that Truman had referred to it as a military base, so I thought it was ridiculous. But I did not know that originally they were focusing on the military, primarily military target, and then shifted the target to attack more civilians. That's a war crime. Now, I remember I was talking about this with Uncle Otto one time, and so I said to him, you know, what the Americans did in Hiroshima was wrong, you know, in killing innocent people. And of course, as I said, I did not know about this, that they actually shifted the target. I say that to my embarrassment. I've studied this many times. I didn't know until I was researching for this podcast. And I'll give you a link to it so you can look at it yourself. I didn't know until I was researching for this podcast episode that they actually altered the target, moved the target to include more civilians. But anyway, I was talking about this with Uncle Otto, and Uncle Otto, you know, he was in World War II, fought in World War II under MacArthur. And he said, well, we were in Leyte in the Philippines, you know, they were being trained for the invasion of Japan. And it was going to be bad. And so the message he was communicating to me, of course, was, you know, he probably would have been killed. So in a wartime situation, who has to die? The women and children of Hiroshima or Uncle Otto? You know, believe it or not, the answer is painfully simple. How do you make that choice? You don't make that choice. You don't do that. You target military installations. And then, you know, let come what may. And so this is what was wrong with the way the Americans did that. Now, I could get into the bombing of Dresden, but I'm not going to go there. I would focus on what I told you was the standard. That the way they dealt with Hiroshima was definitely wrong. But the occupation was very ethical. MacArthur got off the plane in Tokyo or Yokohama, anyway. And no weapon, you know. And they tried to get him to take at least a sidearm. And the Japanese soldiers were lined up on both sides, armed to the teeth. And they had their backs toward the center, which was actually a sign of respect. And so they're worried about MacArthur, you know. Any one of those guys could have turned around and blown him away. And MacArthur said, no, we did not come to dominate these people. We came to lead them. Now, lest you think I'm elevating the American way of doing things as if America's always right. You know, there are Americans and there are Americans. And I was in a library in Williston one time, just kind of seeing a book featured there. I didn't read the whole book, but I just picked it up and going through it. It was written by an officer from the Vietnam period, whose father was an officer in World War II. And he was talking about, he was in, I think, a northern city, a naval base or something. It might have even been Sukkoto, but I don't think it was. Anyway, there was a naval installation. He had the ship there, and the local official, Japanese official, comes walking up the gangplank and to, you know, help with the transition, you know, seeing if he can, just very politely asking how he can help with the transition. And the admiral said, I grabbed that Jap by the seat of the pants and gave him a turkey trot down the gangplank. So I knew we'd never be able to control this place until we showed those Japs who was in charge. That's also an American response. So as I said, there are Americans and there are Americans. When I saw that, I was just absolutely astounded when I read that book. I mean, if that had been my father, I would have not have put it in the book. I would have hoped nobody ever found out about it. He was bragging it as if this is, you know, the tough guy approach. And just horrifying, you know. But MacArthur was not that way. MacArthur was kind to the Japanese people. He broke up the big plantations and gave them their individual farms. He said, I'm going to give women the right to vote because women hate war. And, you know, in so many ways he was pulled away by the Korean conflict, but in so many ways he helped that transition. But contrast that with the way Israel has dealt with the Palestinians. Understand, nothing justifies what Hamas did. But I am deeply concerned when I hear people talking about, you know, lots of innocent people being killed in West Bank, in Gaza, and then people are saying, well, it's on Hamas. You know, innocent people are dying. A child, a little Palestinian child is killed. That little child is just as dead as any Jewish child is killed. I don't like when little children are killed. I don't care whose little children it is. So the handling of this, again, nothing justifies what Hamas did, but the handling of this has been way out of balance. And there has been an attitude on the part of Israelis that has built a lot of resentment among Palestinians. I put another map on my blog, which I encourage you to take a look at. It shows the control of the West Bank and Gaza, but primarily West Bank. Because I sometimes hear Americans say, you know, Israel has given the Palestinians the West Bank and Gaza, so they should be happy. Look at that map and see how much of the West Bank is actually controlled by Palestinians. The way they have been treated is really despicable. And it has built deep, deep resentment. There's a lot of talk, I mean, as I said, it came from an evangelical background. And evangelicals tend to say, well, you know, when the Arab states attacked Israel, the Palestinians left their homes, so too bad for them, you know. I think they left their homes because they were terrified. And they lost their homes. I was watching Al Jazeera one time and I saw a guy went back to Israel and visited the home where his family had lived. He wasn't trying to take it back again. He just wanted to see it. The sad thing, you know, many, many, many Palestinians lost their homes. And they ran because they were terrified. And after this happened, the Israelis reached out to the Palestinians. And they said, no, you don't need to run from us. We won't hurt you. Please come back and take your homes. And you can live among us. No. Sorry, that's not the way it happened. Those Palestinians never got their homes back. It was like, okay, your homes are not ours now. Enjoy your refugee camps. It's just sad what has happened to the Palestinians. The way they were treated and the way they are still being treated. Now, it's understandable the Jews want to fight for their homeland. And as I said, and I've always said, I support their right to have a country. I support the right of the Jews to have a country, just like I support the right of the Japanese to have Japan and the Norwegians to have Norway and the Finns to have Finland. I support the right of the Jews to have Israel. I support that. But, you know, the Palestinians, you don't have to show that they had some kind of country called Palestine to be upset by the way they're treated. Whether or not they had a country or whether they're Bedouins in the desert, that was their home. So the Jews have a right to be there, but the Palestinians have a right to be there too. And the way that situation was handled was very unjust, you guys. And we should be concerned about that. We understand the Jews want to focus on their nation and their right to exist as a country. We understand that. We understand why the Arabs, you know, more concerned about Palestinians. But as Christians, we have to be concerned about both. We have to care for both the sons of Ishmael and the sons of Isaac. You know, we have to be concerned about the right of the Jews to have their country, but we also need to be very, very vocal about the way Israel treats the Palestinians. They have been treated unjustly. They have had their homes taken from them. They are still having homes taken from them. They're having land edged away from them. The way they're being treated is unjust. Now, if you're a supporter of Israel and you say, well, that land was promised to them by God, well, then God can give it to them. We don't try to force God's hand. You know, we don't use unjust means to accomplish God's purpose. Now, I don't want to keep going on and on about that. I will be coming back to that from time to time. I'm not going to let that issue die. We do need to deal with how Israel treats the Palestinians. And if you want to see a good example of it, go back and read that book review. It's interesting. I just finished... When was I back in May or something? Anyway, it's convenient that I did that book review before this happened, because a lot of the issues that we're talking about, I've written and documented. So go back and read that book review, but there's a story there about a Palestinian farmer in the West Bank. Israelis come in and just bulldoze their orchard. Just unspeakably cruel, disgusting behavior on the part of Israelis toward Palestinians. We should not support that. And we do need to put pressure on Israel to reform their approach. But getting back to the issue of terrorism, when you have, as I said, when you have a military target and you attack that military target and some civilians are killed, you can still be viewed as fighting a war and not necessarily as a terrorist. But when you attack primarily civilians, then you're a terrorist. And what has Israel been doing? As I said, in every one of those previous cases, they went in, blew up some buildings, terrorized the local people, and then went out again. So, you know, is Israel's approach about conquering an enemy and defeating an enemy, or is it about getting even? That's where terrorism comes from, you guys. And sorry, but that has been Israel's approach. That has been their approach. And we do need to speak out against that. Now, they're always saying about how they leave, you know, war in the civilians and so on. I'm not so sure. I'm hearing a different story from the ground in Palestine. Now, I don't accept Hamas's word for anything. They have totally destroyed their credibility. And this is one thing that irritates me about opponents of Israel, quoting all these figures from Gaza as if they have any accuracy at all. They, at the beginning of this conflict, they fired a missile. It misfired. It landed in a parking lot of a hospital. That was their missile. It was not a bomb from Israel. Hamas issues a statement that Israel bombed a hospital and killed 500 people. And, of course, everybody swallows it hook, line, and sinker. Like a bunch of idiots. Sorry, but just people are so gullible. I saw that hospital, you know, it wasn't even hit. No, some people might have been killed, but if they were killed, they were killed by Hamas. It was their rocket that misfired. And people are talking about how, you know, this Israel bombed a hospital and killed 500 people. No, so, you know, after that, here's the thing. Okay, Hamas, you got your propaganda thing. You know, you accomplished something. But would you may accomplish something for this instance, but you lose for the rest of the time, because, you know, as just like in a court of law, if someone perjures himself on the stand, the judge can instruct the jury, you can ignore anything this person says. Anything they've said, they've shown themselves to be dishonest. And so, don't listen to anything Hamas says. They've shown themselves to have absolutely zero integrity. So, I don't know how many children are being killed in Gaza. I don't know if anybody knows. I do not accept Hamas's figures, because they're liars. They've shown that. They've demonstrated clearly that they completely fabricate information. And by the way, the media does it too. I was watching Al Jazeera. Even after it was shown that that was a rocket that had misfired, and interestingly enough, it was Al Jazeera's own video that showed it. every other network is showing Al Jazeera's video, and Al Jazeera's, you know, reporting that this had, that other people were reporting that this had been a rocket that misfired, but still carrying the same story that Israel had blown up a hospital. So there again, you know, Al Jazeera continuing to carry a story that they knew was false. Once you do that, I don't trust you anymore. I don't trust you anymore. You say something, public statements you know to be false. You can't be trusted. So I have no respect for Hamas, but there have been reports from the ground in Palestine about innocent people, little children suffering and being killed. And supposedly they're warning that they're going to be, one guy said, they told us they're going to be bombing in 10 minutes, and 2 minutes later the two little children were killed. Well, I don't know. It's hard to verify these stories. But, you know, when I see that, Paul Joseph Wanset called it carpet bombing, and I think that's a good term for it. The Israel, when we only take Hamas targets, give me a break. I see these buildings falling down one after another. Those are all Hamas targets? Any residential structure, any apartment building is a Hamas target? No, I don't accept that. Now, understand, they do need to take Hamas out. If they don't take Hamas out this time, I will never respect them. And that's why, I just saw the other day, Security Council had a vote, and the Americans were the only ones who voted against that ceasefire. And the headline says, Americans oppose humanitarian ceasefire. What a fraud. What is a humanitarian ceasefire? If you say, well, that's so that they can, like they did, you know, so they could exchange some hostages and bring some supplies, medical supplies. And well, that's not what this is. So they put the word humanitarian in there just to deceive people. This wasn't a humanitarian ceasefire. It's basically an end of hostilities. End the conflict. And in other words, leave Hamas in power. The Americans were right to oppose it, and the British are cowards because, you know, they didn't support it, but they abstained. They should not have abstained. It's wrong. That's the problem with the ceasefire. The ceasefire is, now I read one article where they say, well, what happened on October 7th, that's past now. No, it's not. If you leave Hamas in power, that's going to be in the future over and over again. So you have to defeat the enemy. You have to defeat the enemy. But then you have to lead. And you see, that's where there's a great weakness in Israel's approach. They're still saying now, well, no, we don't want to lead them. You have to lead them. That's what Israel needs, is a MacArthur. Someone who is concerned about the well-being of the people. MacArthur, T.J. Bach, the head of the Evangelical Alliance Mission. I believe it was 1950, he was in the office of MacArthur, Supreme Allied Command in Tokyo. And so MacArthur asked him, he said, how many missionaries do you have in the field now? And T.J. Bach said, we have 70. And MacArthur said, I need you to bring 10 more for everyone you have now. We need 10,000 missionaries and 1 million Bibles. We're going to make Japan a Christian country. Now, I'm pretty sure both the Jews and the Muslims would object to making Gaza a Christian country. But, you know, that's not their concern. The spiritual condition of people is not their concern. And that's why they keep losing. Because they don't address the spiritual condition of the people. Now, some might say that I have a bias because my parents were MacArthur missionaries, basically. I was talking to a Japanese pastor in Beijing several years ago. And he said, in the old days, we had two kinds of missionaries, China missionaries and the MacArthur missionaries. And he was right. The missionaries came over from China after they were kicked out of China in 1949, after 1949. And then people like my parents, they came later. They were too young to, you know, they came too late for China. So they went to Japan, and they had a tremendous impact on the country. I remember going to the Institute in Basic Youth Conflict. Bill Gothard, his father was the head of the Gideons, I think. he got a call from MacArthur. I mean, MacArthur took a personal interest in reforming the society. Determined to get as many Bibles as he could. Now, was MacArthur himself a living Christian? Well, I don't know. Can't judge him, but he clearly saw that the spiritual condition of the people was important, and he wanted to lead them. And I don't see that in Israel. That's what Israel needs, that's what Gaza needs, that's what the Palestinians need, is a MacArthur, a benevolent dictator. They need to be occupied. They need to be occupied. Calling Israel occupiers, I mean, of course, usually when they say that, they're actually talking about Israel itself being occupied. You know, not just Gaza. And that's one thing where I give credit to Ben Shapiro. He asked them, what's being occupied, just Gaza or all of Israel? And they say, all of Israel. Well, it's good that he pushes them to that. But then he said, well, then you're advocating genocide. No. I don't want to get into that subject. I'll probably do a separate podcast on it. I have a bee in my bonnet about that word genocide anyway. So it's hopelessly overused. And we just have the news now about the three professors. Well, in my opinion, they walked into a trap. But it's their own fault because there was a hopelessly tone deaf. But I don't want to deal with that now. I don't want to talk about that now. I'll deal with that another time. The word genocide. But there has to be leadership. Israel's problem is not that they're occupying Gaza. Israel's problem is that they have neglected to occupy Gaza. They moved out of Gaza and allowed and turned those poor people over to a bunch of terrorists. I can't remember now if I mentioned the lady who came up to Dad on the street in Sakata after World War II. Dad was in Japan, and she said, "Thank you for winning the war." They were glad to be through with that cruel military dictatorship. And contrary to what you hear in the news, I can bet there are a lot of people in Gaza who would be very happy if Hamas was out of power. And this is my strongest criticism of Israel. They do not care about the Palestinians. We don't want to lead them. They say that. They need to lead. But where is a kind, benevolent leader who can actually care about the Palestinians? Remember, I told you what my standard is. The occupation of Japan after World War II. Now, I know, when a lot of people say, "Eric, you know, you expect them to be handing out Bibles." And no, they're not going to deal with the spiritual conditions. Okay. You see what you get from it. Look at Japan, how peaceful and prosperous it is. But, you know, America has done the same thing with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan. After they pulled out of Afghanistan, they said, "No, we don't need to have boots on the ground. We can shoot them from over the horizon." So they fired a missile just to show off. Killed a bunch of aid workers. And first Americans are saying, "Oh, these are terrorists." And then kind of, "Well, maybe they weren't terrorists." And I was sitting on my deck listening to Fox News, Jennifer Griffin, saying, "Oh, no human casualties." And the next day, "Oh, there might have been a few human casualties." And I'm listening to the BBC, and they're actually describing the funeral. Seven long coffins and three short ones, or three long ones and seven short ones, I can't remember. 10 people killed. They were aid workers. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, the New York Times, you know, there's a big headline, New York Times breaks the story. Somebody from the New York Times happened to read it, listen to an old podcast of BBC NewsHour that was already gathering dust. Several weeks later, you know, the Americans finally come around to acknowledging that it was a disaster. The Americans are afraid to lead. And since MacArthur received the surrender of the Japanese in the battleship Missouri, the Americans have not been able to defeat an enemy. The Americans are losers. They can't win wars. So I don't just blame Israel. I also blame America. But, you know, again, I cannot say this with enough emphasis. Nothing justifies what Hamas did. And so this is my biggest frustration. All the critics of Israel, they can't bring themselves to condemn Hamas. So I don't want to hear anything they have to say. If you can't bring yourself to say that that, you know, that is evil, that what they did is evil, then I'm not interested in what you have to say. You're not morally fit to be sitting at the table. And so this is the problem. The critics of Israel, you know, it's what they're basically saying is, you know, we don't mind those babies being killed because they're Jew babies. They don't care. No man careth for his soul, thus cry the millions. What really needed, what really is needed is benevolent leadership, not democracy. The people of Gaza don't need democracy right now. They need benevolent leadership. Who will take this challenge? You know, before this whole thing happened on October 7th, I was thinking, you know, actually the Americans should invade Gaza and rule it. You know, I still had this idea about MacArthur. But that type of leadership can bring peace and stability. But I don't think Israel cares enough about the people of Gaza to really lead them into peace and develop a, you know, peaceful society. Should they be annexed into Israel? I don't know. Those are decisions that have to be made in the future. But they are part of Israel. They are part of Israel's responsibility. And Israel does need to lead them. But I don't see anybody really expressing that kind of concern. Not the Israelis and not American evangelicals. We just look at the disaster in Gaza and say, it's on us, it's on us. Oh, God have mercy. Well, I have so much else to talk about. But it's already, I've been talking for an hour and 20 minutes. So I'm going to have to wrap this up. And I'll come back and deal with these issues. As I said, a recent news item about the three professors in response to the question about genocide. I'll talk about that. If I were in their position, I mean, they walked into a trap because they were asked about genocide. I would have said, no, of course that's not appropriate. But fortunately, nobody's calling for genocide. Who's calling for genocide? From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. That's not necessarily a call for genocide. It is a call for removing Israel from power. But it's not a call for genocide. So that issue, word genocide, has been misused. And I'm going to talk about that, but I'll have to do it at a later time. Okay, you guys, you've been very patient, and so we'll end it for today. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is hosted online at beijingdiary.podbean.com. That's beijingdiary.podbean.com.